Good morning. I'm calling to order this meeting of the House Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development Committee. I'm Representative Dave Pinto, the co-chair of the committee, along with Representative Dave Baker. Welcome to all. Apologies to be starting a couple minutes late. We have a couple bills today and then a presentation from the Department of Labor and Industry. And we're going to start with the minutes. Chair Baker, are you okay approving the moving approval of the minutes?
Yes, so moved, Mr. Chair, from last Thursday, February 26th?
I believe 26th, all right. Yes. So yeah, good. Yeah. Thank you, Chair Baker. Any additions or corrections, members, to those minutes? Not seeing any, I'll note we do have a quorum. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. The minutes from February 26th are adopted. Members, we're going to change the order around a little bit. We've got some guests here for the bill that Chair Frazier is moving, and so we're going to start with that one, if that's okay. So Chair Frazier, as he makes his way up, he moves House File 2581 to bring that before the committee. Welcome, Chair Frazier, and then, yeah, I've got some guests up there. Once you're ready, Chair Frazier, please present your bill, and then we'll turn to your testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Baker, Co-Chair Pinto, committee members. Thank you for the time to present House File 2581. Research from the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis shows that self-employment is one of the most important pathways to wealth building in our economy. For many Minnesotans, especially those in communities that have historically been excluded from traditional wealth building opportunities, entrepreneurship is not just an aspiration, it is a pathway to stability, ownership, and generational progress. But starting and sustaining a business requires access to capital, and our traditional lending system was not built with everyone in mind. Conventional lenders rely heavily on collateral, real estate, savings, and other assets, along with strong credit scores, operating history, personal wealth, and extensive financial documentation. Those benchmarks are deeply shaped by long-standing geographical, racial, and gender wealth gaps. The result is measurable disparity. According to a 2023 Small Business Credit Survey, black-owned businesses are denied financing at nearly twice the rate of white-owned businesses. At the same time, banks and traditional lenders are highly regulated, including oversight by the FDIC to protect customers, assets, and maintain financial stability. That oversight serves an essential purpose, but it also limits flexibility in what institutions can fund and under what terms, particularly for startups or entrepreneurs without traditional forms of collateral. That is where innovative, mission-driven capital partners come in. Fortis Capital ensures that viable Minnesota businesses are not denied opportunities simply because the traditional system was not built for them. This bill supports that vision, not by replacing our financial institutions, but by complementing them and expanding the ecosystem of responsible capital available to entrepreneurs. If we are serious about workforce development, we must also be serious about entrepreneurship development. When we expand access to fair and flexible capital, we strengthen local economies, close opportunity gaps, and move closer to a Minnesota where success is determined by innovation and hard work, not by whether you inherited collateral. I thank you for your appreciation of this bill. I'll turn it over to Brian Smith, CEO of Fortis Capital, to talk more about the bill and the work that he plans to do.
Thank you, Chair Frazier. So, Mr. Smith, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. Welcome to you.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. Good morning, Chair Pinto, Chair Baker, and members of the committee. My name is Brian Smith, and I'm the co-founder and CEO of Fortis Capital, a Minnesota nonprofit engaged in economic development finance. Fortis was established in 2019, and with our first loan being deployed in 2021. Our mission is simple. We bridge the gap through creative financing for entrepreneurs and our partners. We unlock access to debt capital for deserving Minnesota businesses that are systematically underserved by identity, geography, or lack of traditional banking access. Our vision is to ensure entrepreneurs can access capital regardless of who they are or where they live. The problem in Minnesota. Across Minnesota, thousands of small businesses, particularly in rural communities, communities of color, immigrant communities, and low wealth areas, are unable to secure traditional financing. Many are viable, revenue-generating businesses, but they are denied capital because they lack traditional collateral, lengthy credit history, generational wealth, or proximity to major financial institutions. When businesses cannot access capital, jobs are not created, main streets and business corridors decline, local tax base shrinks, economic disparities widen, communities become unstable and less safe. The issue is not talent or work ethic. The issue is access. Our solution, how Fortis works. Fortis Capital partners with community organizations, financial institutions, and ecosystem leaders to deploy innovative financing models that make lending possible when traditional underwriting says no. We structure flexible debt products, leverage partnerships to reduce risk, fill financing gaps that banks cannot, and unlock growth capital for scaling businesses. Our approach does not replace banks, it strengthens the pipeline into them. Every loan we structure represents a business stabilized, jobs created or retained, wealth generated locally, a stronger Minnesota economy. We don't provide grants. We're providing responsible capital that circulates multiple times within our communities. Specific products that we have are listed in the packet that you have, and those products have done the following. We respectfully request $1 million in state investment to expand the following. Increase lending capacity in underserved regions, de-risk innovative capital structures, expand partnerships statewide, and accelerate small business growth and job creation. With this investment, we will unlock significantly more private capital alongside state dollars, multiplying the impact of this appropriation. This is catalytic funding, not static funding. This request directly advances workforce development, small business growth, rural economic vitality, leveraging dollars that would otherwise be inaccessible, closing racial and geographic wealth gaps, and if you also look in your packet on slide 4, you can see the impact that Fortis has had over the course of our lending history. And just to highlight a few things, and I'll wrap up, is on slide, slide 6 in your packet. Since our deploying our first loan in 2021, we've given 37 loans at over $4 million from Fortis, leveraging another $29.5 million, created 314 jobs, and those are a mix of full-time, part-time, and seasonal jobs because of construction and economic development finance through construction and building new buildings. And overall, it's been a we've been able to leverage 7 times the amount of money that we have raised ourselves by partnering with other CDFIs, banks, and other community institutions. And with that said, I will stand for questions.
Okay, good. And you see, you had another testifier there, but just for questions, or were you going to testify? The other testifier, Mr. Smith.
Chair Pinto.
Yeah.
Next to me is the Chief Strategy Officer for Fortis Capital.
Okay.
And she's here in case there are some questions that I can't answer because I can't remember everything all the time.
No, good. That's why you have a team. Before we go to questions, we'll see, is any member of the public wishes to testify on this bill? And not seeing any, we will move to member questions. Are there questions that folks have? I'll maybe ask one, Chair Frazier and testifiers, just can you talk about how this would fit into the other programs that we have regarding economic development and underserved communities? I guess I'm thinking there's several examples, but just can you kind of how this would fit in the ecosystem of other funding we have, if you have a thought as to that? Chair Frazier or Mr. Smith?
Well, Mr. Smith.
Mr. Smith?
Chair Baker. So Fortis Capital, we provide gap financing. So a lot of the partners and a lot of the people that the legislature have funded over the years, like MEDA, NDC, African Development Center, other people that you've given funders to who are community organizations, they still have a lot of underwriting that is closely tied to bank financing and the same type of stringent underwriting rules and a lack of flexibility. And so a borrower may come in and need $600,000. Sunrise Bank can give them 4. NDC can give them 1. And then there's still that gap, even with the equity that the borrower is bringing in. And because of the lack of flexibility that's allowed at a bank or at a CDFI, Fortis can come in with much more flexibility at much more favorable rates, fill the gap, and that way loosen the rest of the money up. Because if you need $600,000 and you can only get four or five, the deal is off unless you can get the other $100,000. And that's what Fortis Capital over the years have always come in to be able to make deals possible where they wouldn't be possible because of the amount of risk that we're willing to take on a deal where other people just don't do it.
Okay. I may have a follow-up question about that, but I see Representative Greenman has a question. Representative Greenman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may be a question for Representative Frazier or Deed, but I really appreciate, I think we've heard a lot about making sure that we have gap financing and making sure that we have working capital, particularly as it relates to communities and populations that have not had access. So I really appreciate the work. I guess I'm wondering how to follow up on Representative on Chair Pinto's question is, are there at Deed, as we think about this broader gap, are there competitive grant programs that offer this kind of funding as we think about a transition away from named grants in some cases to making sure that Deed has this in a competitive program? I'm wondering, do you know that, Representative Frazier?
I do not know that off the top of my head, so we may need an agency.
See if we can have Mr. Badger make his way on up. Okay. Let me just get a spot for him. Yeah. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Devin Bowdry, Government Relations Director at Deed. I would have to probably know more about the details of what Fortis wants to do as compared to our programs, possibly something like Emerging Entrepreneur Loan Program, but that's the only one that comes to mind.
I'm Representative Greenman.
Thank you. I think that the goal here, and just as we think about our agencies who are managing and spending hundreds of millions of dollars on this, making sure that as we are appropriating resources, it is all working together. And I think the agencies and the government have a role to play in it. So I'd love to hear more about if there is funding sources for this kind of work and the kind of organizations like Fortis that are coming and asking for us. So that's sort of a follow-up as we think about a budgeting.
And Mr. Bowdry, just don't leave. I may have a question, although Mr. Smith looks like wants to say something. Mr. Smith.
Yes. Chair, committee members. Fortis is a part of three different programs at Deed, well, two, and one application is in process. But we're not eligible for grant funds from Deed. But what we are is we're part of the participation program, and we're also a part of the, I always miss, it's so many acronyms.
Yeah.
But
they really are.
The other program is one where the Deed guarantees a portion of the loans up to 80%.
Okay.
And so we're a part of both of those programs, but we weren't eligible for any of the grant programs because the grant programs are for developers who we'd lend to.
Right.
And so we can point them in that direction, but we're not eligible for the grants ourselves to give to clients that we work with.
Mr. Smith, do you know what makes you not eligible for those grant programs? When you say you're not eligible for the existing grant programs, do you know what, is it just, what is the reason that you're not eligible?
The grants go to the actual businesses,
oh,
the borrowers.
Okay,
and so
right,
we're not eligible to receive the money, but we point our borrowers in those directions so that they can get pre-development grant dollars from Deed and other places.
So it does seem like a gap. So you're saying you're not aware of grant programs. Sounds like Mr. Bowdry isn't either, although maybe something to look into, Mr. Bowdry, that there are programs for the kind of work that you're doing and some of the other lenders that you identified, who I think in most cases are receiving direct appropriations. There's not a program to them, to those lenders, is what I'm hearing. Yeah. And yes, so Mr. Bowdry, definitely something to be looking into on behalf of the agency. As long as this topic has come up, just noting that the governor had announced an intent prohibit direct appropriations without an RFP. I think that I know that Chair Baker and I are both on record as being opposed to that, having significant concerns. Our Senate counterparts significant concerns as well. But having said that, still, Chair Baker and I are both interested and certainly trying to move in the direction of having more competitive grants, even recognizing there are some circumstances where direct appropriations are appropriate, in my view. So anyway, this is something we need to be looking into. Representative Greenman, did you have something else? I'm sorry. No, you're all done. Okay, Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. My question is, what is the interest rate for this type of gap financing for the business owner?
Mr. Smith, it's Representative Zalesnikar. Mr. Smith, you're gonna answer? Or?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So the highest interest rate that Fortis has ever had has been 8.5%. And that was on a bridge loan. And the lowest that we've had, as you can see in the packet, we have a 2% interest only product, but on average, we're around 6.5%. We always try to come in at least a point or two below the bank financing or the CDFI that we're partnering with. And in most cases, there's a bank financing with the CDFI, and they still need us to come in and fill the gap.
Representative Lesnikar, follow up? No? Okay. Chair Baker.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're taking the riskiest of the risk, you know, on that transaction, and thank you, because, again, I couldn't have done my first business 25 years ago without having sort of another bridge loan back then with the Initiative Foundations, and again, it's similar to that. What has been your, since 2021, you had your first loan, what has been your default rate from that point?
Mr. Smith.
Chair. And Chair Baker, we've had 30, I'm sorry, sometimes I always forget.
No problem.
32 loans to date, 37, I'm sorry. And we've had two defaults since deploying our first loan in 2021.
Great.
Chair Baker.
Mr. Chair, thanks.
Yeah.
Is this the first time you're requesting money to kind of seed this revolving loan fund? Is the intent to sort of tap into this, so it's kind of a revolving loan? Is this your first time here requesting dollars from our general fund?
Mr. Smith.
Chair Baker, this is the second time that we've requested funds. The first time we received $300,000, and that money's been deployed. And we have, and sorry, what was your, it was two parts to that question.
Chair Baker, it is
a revolving loan fund.
Yeah, right.
So it's a revolving loan fund, and we use some of the interest to support operations,
sure.
And the legislature has allowed us to have 20% of whatever the appropriation is for operations, but the money just keeps revolving over and over and over. And so we try to have our terms at between 7 and 10 years, so that money can come back, help people look for refinancing so that we can get our money back and redeploy as soon as possible.
Thank you.
Chair Baker? Okay. Yeah. And that was actually a direction I was going to go, that if you're taking on loans that others won't, then presumably they're riskier. There's going to be a presumably higher risk of default. Sounds like you're doing a good job assessing. But part of the idea is to be take on more risky investments. So we'll see if there's anybody else. Not seeing any. So Chair Frazier, to you, sir, for final words on your bill.
Thank you, co-chairs, and thank you, committee members, for the robust conversation. I believe here that Mr. Smith has answered the questions quite well and shown that there is a need for this. And I believe we're in the business of solutions for entrepreneurs in our workforce and our economic development, and so I'm looking forward to support for this bill.
Good. Thank you so much, Chair Frazier, and to your testifiers for your important work. And with that, the chair lays over House File 2581 for possible inclusion in a budget bill. So we'll see where we end up. Members, we've got a couple of bills. I think what we're going to do is address a few of these bills, and then to our friends at the DLI, we'll have you do your presentation. So, Representative Berg, yeah, if you can make your way up. The three bills before us that are going to be coming up in a row here, members, are all bills that have been proposed by our agency partners, agency friends. The first one is House File 3707. Representative Berg. Moves that bill before us to be recommended for re-referral to the Judiciary Committee, I believe, if that's correct. Representative Berg, please explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a fairly simple bill. You may recall we did some work in 2024 about protecting personal information for judges. And so this is a safety bill, and specifically talking about UI and paid leave judges, which you may not think would be in any danger. However, since COVID, the staff members who handle those cases have seen an increase in harassment. One instance was a judge was called on their personal cell phone at 11 p.m. when they were home alone. Other instances are when callers say, we know what gym you work out at, or we know what childcare facility your children are at. Pretty scary stuff. And even a case of one of those judges being attacked near the office. And so this is just to add them to have their personal information protected. Pretty simple, pretty easy vote, and I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
And as you do, Representative Berg, I'm reminded that, and I won't get into details, but I'm familiar with some of that, what you describe with that harassment in my work outside the legislature for Ramsey County Attorney's Office. So, yeah, I'm aware of that. Mr. Bowdery, welcome back. Please provide your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Devin Bowdery, Government Relations Director at DEED. Thank you, Representative Berg, for carrying this, and all well stated. So this bill comes out of personnel safety first and foremost, wanting to protect the people who are upholding the integrity of this program. I mean, it's tough news to hear that you've been denied or that there's an issue, but if that's what the law set out, then that's what it should be. As a technical matter, it adds UI and paid leave to the definition of judges, and then lines 2.3 to 2.7 just spell out what the personal information is that is not to be shared. And I think it is a knowing share of information, so accidents not included, but that's all.
Thank you so much. And then to Ms. Breck, welcome. Identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Co-Chair Pinto, Co-Chair Baker, and committee members. For the record, my name is Sydney Spreck, and I'm a political affairs coordinator at the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, or MAPE. MAPE is a union of over 18,000 state workers across all of Minnesota's agencies, boards, and commissions, and we represent some of these administrative judges and judicial officials at both unemployment insurance and paid leave divisions at DEED. MAPE supports HF 3707. Public employees deserve to have their personal information protected. Their jobs require them to make sensitive decisions that can lead them to being targeted by members of the public for harassment and retribution. And this bill simply updates current law, creating a path for these judicial officials to request that publicly posted personal information about themselves be removed, and a protection that is already afforded to other administrative judges performing similar work. I urge committee members to support this bill for passage. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We'll see if there's any member of the public who wishes to testify on this. Not seeing any. Member questions? Yeah, Chair Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Berg, thanks for bringing this forward. I think this has got a lot of important components to this. I'm struggling a little bit with the language, though. 1.18, where you got the changes here, it seems pretty broad. Again, the current retired judges and current employees of the Office of Administrative Hearings, I get where that's going, Department of Economic Development, Unemployment Insurance, and Paid Leave Divisions. It just seems really broad. This means it's almost all employees in paid family. And I wonder, like, are we talking call center? Are we talking everything in paid leave? Because I think it's pretty broad. Or are we just trying to affect the appeals part of paid family? I want to make sure we get the language right. In this manner, so that we don't get it so broad that it's maybe overstepping what we should be doing here. So just I want to get some thoughts to that, Representative Berg.
Representative Berg or Mr. Bowdery. Representative Berg.
Yeah, thank you for the question. I think I understand what you're saying, and I have an answer, but I want to let our deed commissioner go first.
Mr. Bowdery.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, good point. Happy to tailor the language. I think we would also want to judges, as you mentioned, I think we would want to also find a way to protect staff also, particularly in the call center, just because that's another touch point. They also deliver sensitive news and determinations to people. So it would be great if we could capture them in this also, but particularly judges, was the main focus, the appeals unit.
And Representative Berg, looked like you had something, was it something else on that?
Yeah, I agree that we should be protecting as many folks who do this important work as we can. I think this was sort of adding on to the work and the statute we did in the 24th session to protect judges, but certainly want to make sure we encompass everyone that does this work, the MAIT members that do this work. So thank you for flagging that.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I know this has got another step, which is a really important thing here, because I don't think the language is right how I see it. Mm-hmm. We've got a limited time here, and again, I know what's going on. I just think that this needs work on the language, to be specific. I don't know what the costs are, if there's any cost involved with providing different kinds of layers of adjustments to personal data or not, because this is, for me, really, really broadening the divisions language with paid family especially.
Chair Baker, I have an idea, a suggestion. Yep. Well, I wonder about, because I do see your point as well, and I wonder, the next floor session is Thursday. We could potentially have a discussion and bring this back tomorrow. You have the gavel. That would not delay anything for floor session. I hate to do that to Representative Berg and indeed, but I do see the point that you're making. And if we decide the language is good, then you just bring it back up tomorrow. We can move it on to judiciary. But I see the point that the expertise for these agencies, right? Well, I'll let you talk to staff.
And to that, Mr. Chair, I think, again, my thinking was we actually move it out to judiciary and then actually recall the bill back here for a review again. That would be, if you think we have time for that, both avenues are good.
And, well, Mr. Chair, maybe if we figure out what we're doing with the language, then in judiciary they adopt an amendment that at that point we know that it's fine. In any case, I would assume that would be even better from Representative Berg's perspective. We'll keep it moving. So,
I think so.
See your point about the language.
I think it's too broad, and I just want to make sure that that's recognized here again. I like the intent. Yeah, and I think that's what the important part is here. But I would offer that to the author of the bill. So
and Representative Berg, I know you were talking to Mr. Bowdery. We're having some process paths, but Representative Berg, what are your current thoughts? I'm not sure if you caught what we were saying.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I'm open to that. The work that we did was judges, but happy to make sure we're protecting all of our workers. As was mentioned, perhaps the judges make the decisions, but the other staff working on it often deliver the news, which can be pretty hard to take if you're sort of in a desperate economic situation. And so I'm happy to make sure we're protecting all workers.
And Representative Berg, so what we were just talking about was the plan is to send on to judiciary, continue to have a conversation with the language, and then, clearly if there's not satisfaction on both sides, this is not going to advance into law regardless. And so it may well be that we need to bring it back if we can't figure out some language that we feel comfortable with by judiciary. We can have continued conversations. Chair Baker, what are your thoughts, though, about any of that?
Yeah, I think that's what I'm hearing, too, is that we'll go ahead and move it to judiciary now. I certainly may request it to come back to the committee to see what that looks like. Again, this is opening up a much larger conversation, not just it is about employee safety, but how broad is this going to get? I think of all the employees at DHS. I think of all the employees that have to say to a lot of people, sorry, you're not getting your license today for whatever reason it might be. And are they protected? I'm not sure. They're not judges. They're not in the administrative hearing department necessarily. They're just folks telling people some really hard news that government can't respond to you as quickly as we'd like. So I just... Yeah. It's important, but we want to get it right. And so I appreciate that. And again, I think we can support going forward to judiciary. And then we'll likely have it back for a quick review.
Yeah. And moving it on today will not be a statement that we're saying this language is perfect as is, but we're just keeping the conversation going. So good. Representative Berg, final comments on your bill.
Yes, thank you. I think we've said it all in the discussion, but the point is, we want people to be safe. We want them to be able to do their work without fear of retaliation. And so once we do get the language right, I think this is going to be a really important thing to do to guarantee the safety of folks that do good work. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you for carrying it. I'm Representative Berg, and thanks to your testifiers for bringing it to you. and then to us. So with that, Representative Berg renews her motion, House File 3707 be recommended for re-referral to Judiciary Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. The bill is on its way. Continue conversation about the language. Vice Chair Greenman, I'm going to ask you to come to the chair area. I'm going to head up and present a bill.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, I'll
move.
I'll move House File 3732, bring that before the committee. I can't quite recall if we were going to, I think it's just becoming before the committee for now, I think.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I believe that the plan is delayed over. So please present your bill.
All right, thank you so much. Members, House File 3732 is authored by your two co-chairs, and it repeals some unfunded programs and was brought to us by the agency. I'll say candidly that this bill may end up serving as some kind of vehicle bill is what I was thinking. I figured we've talked about that with Chair Baker and Ms. Spencer, but that's why we're going to hold on to this bill for now. I'm not sure if Dee's going to have anything to share about it, but we'll be glad to have your support when the time comes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, members, thank you, Representative Pinto, Representative Baker, for carrying this bill. Just the agency's shot at cleaning up some outdated statutes. I can quick run through the names of the programs that we're looking to repeal. Coordinating Economic Development and Environmental Policy, that's 116J.437. 116J.438, Minnesota Green Enterprise Assistance. 116J.617, Tourism Loan Program. 116J.658, Minnesota Science and Technology Economic Development Project. 116J.872, Economic Response Team, and then a rule 3300.0500. Had to do with some youth programming from a long time ago. The last legislative activity I could find for any of these was 2013. We don't fund any of these, we don't do anything with these, and we can just take them off the books if you choose.
Thank you, Mr. Bowdrey. Members, any questions on this bill? Chair Baker.
Madam Chair, thank you. Appreciate you bringing this forward again. Obviously, I'm a co-author of this. This is making our rules less, and this is good. This is a good thing. Let's clean it up. I appreciate your agency and others that are doing the same kind of thing with, again, just cleaning up our statutes. Again, if they're not being used, let's get them off the books. So I appreciate this and hope we get some support.
Members, any other questions on House File 3732? With that, Representative Pinto, Chair Pinto, do you want to close?
Well, actually is something that I want to say that's reminding me of. So Chair Baker and I are working on, along with our fabulous staff, possible repeal of some other programs as well and trying to sort of clean up the statutes. That's a project we've been working on for a while, but hoping to be able to put those bills in front of you all relatively soon. So this is sort of a small bite at it from the agency, and then we're trying to take a larger look at that as well. And so please expect that to be coming, and that's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. With that, House File 3732 is laid over for possible inclusion.
All right, we're swapping. Okay, Representative Greenman is making her way to the front and is moving House File 3731. For placement on the general register, I believe. And so once you get settled in, Madam Vice Chair, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the theme of cleaning up and taking things off the books that are no longer in use, this bill removes references to the in-state statute to the Class A electrical installers. The license has been defunct. Nobody currently holds the license, and there's no longer a path to acquire the license. I talked to IBEW, and I know that the administration has talked to stakeholders, and there's think, pretty common consensus that without both the license or any holders of the license, it's time to take this off the books. And so with that, I will turn it over to my testifier.
Please identify yourself and proceed. And welcome.
Thank you, Chair and members. Josiah Moore, Department of Labor and Industry. Representative Greenman summed up the bill nicely. This is pure cleanup, and the repeal of this license will have no impact on electricians, workers, or the public because it is defunct. And the department supports the bill. Appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Any member of the public wishes to testify on this bill? Not seeing any. Any member discussion questions? Chair Baker.
Well, thank you, Representative Greenman, for this, and maybe this is for the DLA department. Again, I'm just, what was the Class A license? Tell us a little bit of the history about what we're wiping off the books, and why is it changed today? Because there's so much complexity in the energy world and safety and licensing. Why is this changed over the years?
Mr. Moore.
For that one, I'm going to rely on our expert. We have Dean Hunter with us today from the department, so okay. I'll invite him up.
Come on up. Just grab that chair. Yep. Yeah, no problem. And then once you settle in, if you can identify yourself, please, and then proceed to answer the question.
Thank you, Dean Hunter, Department of Labor and Industry. The Class A electrical installer license has been a part of the electrical piece probably since, I want to guess, it was like in the 1950s. The Class A installer license was put together mainly in the outstate regions or greater Minnesota regions that didn't have licensed electrical contractors at the time. So the Class A installer license was very necessary for residential communities. Less than 1,500 individuals lived in a certain city. They were limited to the types of electrical work that they could conduct. It was only on a residence. It was single phase, 200 amps or less. So there was a lot of limitations to the license until, obviously, the remainder of greater Minnesota saw more growth in the electrical industry with electrical contractors. And I don't want people to confuse this license, because obviously we have the Class A journey worker, the Class A master license that we have, that currently is the licensing model that we have today. So this is just, again, as Josiah and the representative mentioned, just not necessary.
Chair Baker.
So, okay, thank you for that. It sounds like, again, because I know we've got our journeymen, journey workers, we've got our master electricians, we've got our apprentice. Yeah. This one is just kind of duplicative, if you will. It was early in the days, didn't have a lot of specificity to it, maybe, where this is a little bit more now prescribed. So we're just getting rid of that confusion, but it's already confusing because it's all a lot of Class A's in there, too,
exactly.
So which can be challenging. But, okay, I appreciate that historical view. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Baker. And Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm feeling a little bit bad this morning because I didn't reach out to my uncle, who I believe worked for the Department of Labor and Industry and also was an electrician and likely had a role in administering this. He just turned 78 this month, or last month, and I should have reached out to him to make sure that we were doing right by this policy.
And especially said happy birthday.
And said happy birthday, correct. I failed on that front, too. And so just appreciate your work on this, because I'm sure we're doing right by the people of Minnesota with your work. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Representative Greenman.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate this. And just a little bit more history. Apparently, in before my time, Chair Mahoney at the time, in light of, I think, the lack of necessity for it, passed a bill that that said that there were no more licenses that would be issued. And that's why now there are no one with a Class A license. So I think we're at the end of what sounds like a responsible phase out, and to Chair Baker's point, to just clarifying the law. I don't know if you were around during 2007 when that happened, but I was not.
We showed up together.
Just 2015,
Chair Baker.
And I don't want to interrupt, but if you're kind of closing things up, I apologize. Are there currently anyone right now in the state of Minnesota that has any Class A? There's not a single worker out there that has that license that is currently working, because it would be today really out of scope, right? It would be not legal. Is that fair to say?
Is that fair to say? Yeah, okay. And that's a result of, in 2007, we passed a law that no new licenses will be issued. So I think it was a transition out, and we are now at a point, looking at my experts, where there's nobody with this license. So it really is just getting it off the
books. So 15 years later, Mr. Chair, we're safe now to do this without putting anybody at risk with, like, all of a sudden they don't have a license. That's where I just want to make sure. Okay, that's thank you.
Smaller government, Mr.
That's
Chair.
That's it. I like it. Yep.
15 years later. Representative Johnson. Johnson Wayne.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Question I have is, where did people transition? So do they transition into the Class A journeyman, Class A master is what they did? Is that correct?
And, sir, I forget your last name, sir. But
Hunter.
Hunter. I'm sorry, Mr. Hunter. Go,
thank
please.
You, Mr. Chair. So the licensing model that we have today, obviously, is you need to be a Class A master electrician, basically, to be able to obtain the contractor's license. And so, you know, at the time, and again, I was not around in 2007 or previous to that as to why this happened, but currently today in the state of Minnesota, we have right around 5,500 licensed master electricians in the state. So, you know, as a part of the language, it basically stated that there would be no other electrical contractors that were in that community that would allow them, because this license kind of stood on its own, if you will, with the contractor parameters and so on and so forth. So as, you know, master electricians started to obtaining, you know, their licenses, you know, contractor licenses, it just eventually phased this need out.
Okay.
So, Representative Johnson?
Thank you.
Follow-up? Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else, members? This turned into quite more robust conversation than some of us were thinking. That's good, though. Okay. And then Representative Greenman.
Thank you.
Please close.
I appreciate the time we can learn when we have DLI in something about both the history and current licensing structure, especially as it relates to our electricians, and wish Representative Schultz's uncle a happy birthday. So with that, I ask it to be laid over.
Indeed we do. Thank you. Actually, I think it's General Register is where your motion
I'd ask it to be sent to the General Register.
Okay. Representative Greenman renews her motion that House File 3731 be placed on the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Okay. It is on its way. Congratulations. And then finally, members, we have a presentation on the Women's Economic Security Act. I'll ask the folks presenter to make your way on up. Women's Economic Security Act is a little over 10 years old and really groundbreaking. And I'm glad that we're going to have the chance to get an update about how things are going. So once you're ready, please identify yourself. We may, if you want to wait for it looks like presentation's making its way. But please, identify yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, members of the committee. Chair and co-chair, my name is Fuad Ali. I'm a labor standards supervisor with the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry at the Labor Standards Division. I'm here today to represent on the Women's Economic Security Act. The acronym is WESA. This is a law that the department has jurisdiction over, and I'm here particularly to report on our annual report, which is a report that the department is mandated to share with the legislator. It reports on the number of complaints that we've received as well as our rate of resolution. So I'm here today to provide that information. Through this presentation, I'll be providing a brief background on the law on WESA, the enforcement authority the department has, the provisions we enforce at DLI, some of the innovations we've achieved over the course of the last reporting period. I will cover the report data itself, as well as the complaint data and the trends we've seen over the last 3 years.
Mr. Ali, I'll just note for members that the report itself is, members and members of the public as well, the report is on our website. You don't have a physical copy of it. It's a pretty voluminous document. We have the presentation Mr. Ali is walking through, and then the report itself folks can access on our website. So please continue.
Thank you. So WESA was passed in 2014. It has gone through a number of revisions in 2022, 2023, and 2024. It is designed as a comprehensive worker protection plan because it tackles more than one area in the workplace rather than one. More importantly, it aims to secure the economic well-being of women in the workplace. It includes four workplace protections enforced by DLI, the first being the wage disclosure protection. That particular law makes it illegal for employers to stop employees from sharing their wage information and general employment conditions. It also makes it illegal for employers to take any retaliatory action when an employee does so. The pregnancy accommodation law provides pregnant workers faced in pregnancy and health-related conditions the ability to receive reasonable accommodations in the workplace. Those could include transfer to less strenuous positions or hazardous positions, changes in work hours or modification of job duties. That particular law states that employers may not require employees to provide medical certifications when they're asking for three specific law or accommodations. Those are seating, limits on lifting 20 pounds, and extra breaks to consume food, water, and rest. There are anti-retaliation provisions embedded within that law that makes it illegal for employers to take any adverse action when an employee asserts any of those rights. Pregnancy and parenting leave provides employees in conjunction with the birth of a child or adoption of a child, the ability to have access to 12 weeks of unpaid leave. It also covers employees for prenatal care and incapacity due to pregnancy or any health condition related to that. It also has an anti-retaliation provision embedded, therefore employees are protected if they were to witness any adverse action when they assert that particular right. Nursing mothers and lactating employees, that law basically, as it states, gives the right to that group of employees the ability to express milk in the workplace. And it also makes it a requirement for employers to attempt reasonable steps to provide a location for employees to be able to express in the workplace. DLI's enforcement authority. DLI has the authority or vested with the authority to investigate complaints, issue compliance orders, including reinstatement to employment, assess back wages, compensatory damages, and liquidated damages anytime there is an employee affected by a WISA-related violation. For complaints related to nursing mothers specifically and pregnancy accommodations, the department is mandated to establish contact with employers within 2 days and start the investigation within that period and achieve a resolution within a period of 10 days. We have had a number of innovations in the past reporting period in terms of methods and approaches we have adopted over the past reporting period. Informal resolution continued to make up the largest sum of DLI's investigations of WISA-related violations. DLI is mandated to achieve an informal resolution. Educating employers about their legal obligations and asking for voluntary compliance has been a successful approach for DLI to achieve compliance. And this is clearly illustrated in our 2025 report, which shows that we've had successful resolution informally of 116 complaints out of a total of 123. We have instituted the use of pre-enforcement demand letters. These are letters that are used to alert employers of ongoing violations in hope to start a conversation to bring a resolution. They detail the form and nature of potential violations as well as prescribe the necessary corrective action needed to achieve full compliance. Those were issued in cases involving serious violations, particularly when employees appear to be willfully noncompliant with the law or there is a loss of wages that is significant for pregnant employees. And this particular use of letters aims to speed up the informal compliance process and to avoid any protracted legal processes. We have issued a total of 19 pre-enforcement demand letters in the past reporting period. The innovations we've had over the course of this reporting period were around targeted strategic outreach that we engaged in. In the preceding reporting period, we have had collaborations with an OBGYN where we have developed return to work letters that had specific references to language in WISA in hopes to provide that to workers who are going back to work that can facilitate their ability to get the protections under the law. Over the course of this last reporting period, we have conducted outreach to resident physicians because we received positive feedback from one of the major hospitals in Minnesota that this particular use of letters made it effective for clinicians to be able to support their patients. We've administered and created training material for resident physicians that overview WISA, the protection it entails, and deliver that to them. And it's important for us to speak with this particular group because they are under training. So being exposed to this material at this stage is really impactful. And we aim to expand the impact of our work by hopefully also influencing them to adopt similar return to work letters as they start their own practices once they finish their training. DLI has also collaborated with its grant recipients over the past reporting period who were able to convene a total of 70 practitioners from different backgrounds, including medical doctors, doulas, and lactation specialists, as well as organization staff from organizations that work with families. We have created avenues for conversation and to develop practical knowledge around the law and what it entails in hopes to affect our stakeholders who have already contact with these members of the community. So participants walked away with concrete resources on WISA and a renewed interest to continue to advocate for their clients after the information they've been exposed to. Third-party administrators are organizations that employers outsource certain administrative work to, including disability and leave compliance-related services. Our investigations showed that there were drivers of incompliance in the past reporting period. So we've created training material and reached out to them to help explain how their business models and practices were driving incompliance in hopes to affect their conduct. Obviously, they work with so many Minnesota-based employers, so it was important for us to make contact with one of the largest third-party administrators that work with a large number of Minnesota-based employers to educate them on the law in hopes to affect their ability to achieve compliance in this area of the law. We have made contact us also with staff and agencies because our investigations also show that they were a major player in achieving compliance with WISA. They recruit a lot of workers for Minnesota-based employers. Therefore, it was important for us to establish contact with them. They enter into joint employment relationships with all the employers that they recruit workers for by virtue of their continued contact, oversight, and continual administration of compensation. So we created training material that helped them understand the dual obligations and the dual liabilities that they face as joint employers in hopes to also effectuate more compliance by incentivizing them to make sure that anytime they place an employee into one of their client employers, that they also continue to make sure that their basically business partner will remain in compliance with Minnesota state law. We have trained a total of 30 staff members that are dispersed throughout 15 different branches in the state of Minnesota. These are the numbers, the data that I'm here to share with you. It reflects the reporting period between September 2024 through August of 2025. The left side of the table provides the provisions under the law, and the right side provides the actual number of intakes we received per provision. The information on this table is driven from our contacts with the public, which is either through walk-in or contact through email, telephone conversations, or letter to the department. So these numbers provide the basis for the investigations that we've delved into and the complaints that were alleging violations of WESA. We had a total of 675 intakes in the past reporting period. This table provides information on the actual investigations that we've delved into in the past reporting period. Again, the left side provides the provisions under the law, the specific complaint numbers, complaints closed, and the number of violations found. We have closed a total of 118 complaints, and we've received a total of 123 complaints. Obviously, the difference between the two are five investigations that were still remaining open by the time the report was being drafted. The employee notice provision, if I can go briefly over that, you will see that we've received a total of 12 complaints, but we've had a total of 34 closed, and that is because we've actually seen through our investigations that even though complaints were coming under this area of the law, there were other times where provisions were being alleged to have been violated, such as nurse and mother rights or pregnancy and parenting leave rights, but then also employers were also violating the notice requirement, which basically it's a provision that states employers have to provide notice at the hire and then at the time when an employee makes a request for parental leave about their rights to nurse and mother's rights and accommodations in the workplace. This slide shows the progressive increase in the number of investigations and complaints we've had over the course of 3 years. You would see the period ending on August 2023, we've only had a total of 24 complaints, and we basically 24 investigations. The period ending in August 2024, that number increased to 77, and then the last reporting period, that number increased to 123. You would see that between 2024 and 2025, that increase reflects 59.74% increase in the overall number of investigations and complaints we received. And from 2023 to 2025, the increase from 24 to 123, that's a five-fold increase, or 412.5 increase in the total number of investigations we've delved into. So DLI was successful in informally resolving most complaints. It achieved a 94.3% resolution rate, and we were able to do so by educating employers about their legal obligations, which often resulted in voluntary corrective action. DLI secured volunteer agreements from employers to pay a total of $81,574.10 in back wages, compensatory damages, and liquidated damages to a total of 21 affected employees. DLI issued a total of $40,000 in civil penalties and stayed a total of $160,000 pending further compliance with the law over the past reporting period. In conclusion, I would like to say that DLI will continue to focus on educating both employees and employers about their rights and responsibilities under the law. Informal resolutions of complaints will continue to be the agency's primary enforcement tool, and most employers willingly and expeditiously do come into compliance. Supporting pregnant and new parents in the workplace to protect their safety and economic security and help employers to come into compliance will continue to be DLI's goal into the future. And that concludes my presentation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Thanks so much for your work and to the department as a whole. Members, questions, discussion? Representative Johnson, Jay. Johnson, Pete. P. There we go.
Thank you, Chair. My question is around some of those third-party administrators that seem to, like you said, are driving up some of these issues. Do you guys keep track of which third-party administrators are creating more of the problems? And then if you aren't able to settle them, who's held accountable? Is the employer held accountable with the fines, or does that fine hit that third-party administrator?
Mr. Early.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, we do keep track of them. So every time we have an investigation where we see the driver of incompliance as being a third-party administrator, we take note of that. The reason we've conducted specific outreach to this particular third-party administrator because we've noticed that they were more or less a repeat offender. We've had a number of investigations where it always came back to that third-party administrator staff being not very well-versed with WISA. They often are located in different states, and they're not based in Minnesota. So they are looking at it from a federal law perspective, and they're not necessarily very well-versed with Minnesota state law. I hope that answers your question. There was a second part to it I may be missing.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, the second part was, if it gets to the point where it's unable to be resolved, and a fine is administered, does that fine go to the employer that hired the third-party administrator, or is the third-party administrator at all held accountable?
Ms. Shirley.
Thank you, sir. It goes to the employer, and we've had a number of investigations where at the end of the day, the employer is responsible for the, in compliance with the law. So, but we enter into certain agreements that they will continue to make sure that their third-party administrator, whoever that might be, will continue to comply with the law. We've had instances where we made third-party employers partake in training sessions that DLI has administered, where they convened all their workers that work with any of Minnesota-based employers, and that was basically a condition for resolving the complaint and the investigation, is that they will have to partake in training that make sure they understand what the law states in hopes to, affect their compliance into their future. And that seems to work.
Representative Johnson. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. The last question then is that publicly available data to see which third-party administrators are some of the bad actors? Like thinking of it through an employee lens, a lot of times these cities will hire these third-party administrators. And if there's one that's got a known history of doing things like that, it could possibly help those employees maybe realize that if this something is happening and they're getting answers that they don't know or don't think are correct, is there a way for them to look and see if a organization or one of those third-party administrators does have a history of this, and then if that third-party administrator works for their organization, maybe their answers they're getting from that third-party administrator aren't necessarily accurate.
Mr. Early?
So if that is part of an investigation that's been closed, that data is public, subject to the Data Practices Act, so that could be public, but we don't necessarily publish that information about, we don't release a list of third-party administrators that we think are bad actors. And just to clarify, they do often come into compliance. It's not a matter of they wanted to not cooperate. They often, once they realize that their conduct is affecting their business partner's ability to remain in compliance, which is the main reason they outsource that administrative task to, they often want to come into compliance and they do everything we ask. So.
Okay, Representative Johnson, anything else? No? Okay. Chair Baker, you're next on the list. Representative Wayne Johnson is also on the list. Should I go to him first?
I can go first.
Yeah, Chair Baker.
I'll just be quick
right.
about this.
Yeah,
I
no
think.
Problem.
Mr. Early, thank you for the presentation. How long have you been sort of the supervisor of this Economic Security Act? And how big is that department as well? Sorry.
Yeah, Mr. Early.
So I'm a labor standards supervisor. I've been a supervisor for going into 2.5 years now. The labor standards division oversees all the laws, the wage and hour laws that we enforce, including ESST, paid leave, and everything else that come under our jurisdiction. So there isn't a supervisor for WISA per se. Okay. I just happen to be a supervisor who oversees that segment of investigations, but our staff work on all the laws that we are mandated to enforce. Some staff with subspecialties, so to speak.
Chair Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. That helps. And again, as an employer myself, and I almost asked myself when I first started seeing this presentation, like, why do we still have the need for this? You know, it seems like as employers, we've learned and grown and understood the need for being compliant and also being accommodating to women, especially with the things that we've learned over the years. And just, and again, I hope we get to that point someday. We're not there today, but I'm just, I'm glad we're having this conversation. You said that the last year you had 94% voluntary compliance of sort of settling the complaints, which is good news. Are you seeing in your time there, or if you have history, is that getting higher and higher and higher every year? Are folks, once they get a phone call from your office, oh, I didn't realize that, I will get on this, and they fix it, and I think, I hope that that's a quick fix and there's no fines or penalties. Is it going in that direction, Mr. Ali? The compliance, the voluntary compliance?
Mr. Shirley.
Yes, I would say so. That's definitely what is the trend, is that sometimes we have to take enforcement actions because the issues affect more than one employee in the workplace. It's more of a systemic issue that needs more compliance-related like remedies that we have to implement to make sure that that employer will come into compliance long-term. But often when the issues involve single employees or a small number of employees, if we do enter into conversation with employers, they tend to want to come into compliance, as this report illustrates.
All right. Chair Baker. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Representative Johnson W.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Thank you for the presentation. I asked just some questions on the investigation summary, the complaint data, and I just wanted to see if I'm reading this correctly, that every complaint filed or closed resulted in a violation being found, which I thought was kind of interesting, that there's no, oh, I'm sorry, there was a misunderstanding. No, they really didn't do anything. So basically, by the time somebody filed, that there was a legitimate complaint and that somebody just didn't misunderstand. And then the follow-up there is, if the violation found, does that mean for the complaint filed, or does this also include that maybe you went in for an original complaint and found another violation, not necessarily the complaint that was filed, and then that's counted as the violation found? If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Ms. Shirley.
Sorry. Thank you. Okay. So, yes, that is true. We often receive complaints alleging a violation of a certain area of the law, but then when we do an investigation, it turns out that there are also other violations involved in other areas of the law that impact more than one employee. The reason we have had all the complaints we received have had closures on them that shows violations found is because this table only reports on the actual instances when we've actually conducted an investigation. There are some times where employees contact us and the information they're providing to us does not rise to a level of a violation where we would be mandated to investigate because there is a misunderstanding of the law or they don't clearly understand what the law states in terms of their rights. So we wouldn't initiate an investigation in those instances. And those wouldn't be reflected on this table. But everything on this table is basically investigations that we've started because it was clear to us that there is, if the allegations were to be true, then there is a clear violation of the law as it's written.
Thank you.
One more. Sure. Yeah, Representative Johnson, yeah.
Thank you. Based on that, do you still, I'm just curious, how many phone calls you actually receive or contacts you get received, people thinking that there are actual violations?
So Mr. I can Charlie. Tell you that all the 123 report in this table are conversations primarily over telephone or email correspondence where people are saying, I'm facing this issue, what does the law say? And then we explain to them what their rights are and they're clear that there's a violation taking place and they want to file a complaint. The other table that we've had that represented the total of 675 intakes, that is driven from telephone conversations, emails, walk-ins to the department, and letters to the department. So I don't have the specific data that kind of stratifies which area of the law where telephone calls made in versus letters. I can get that to you. I can go back and see if we have that those numbers available to share with you. But as of right now, the 123 we're reporting is the total number of alleged violations that we've delved into to investigate.
Thank you. Well,
when
you
Johnson.
Take into consideration how many hundreds of thousands and millions of people that are employed, I think that shows that you know, employers are still doing a very good job of respecting and understanding the law. And so to see that number that small, if you take it into consideration, I know it was brought up that there's still employers that but you consider the millions of hundreds of thousands of millions out there that I think employers are doing a good job with that. So thank you.
Good. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Members, anything else? I have just one basic question, Ms. Shirley. Despite the name of the Women's Economic Security Act, a lot of this relates to gender and pregnancy, but not everything, right? In particular, the wage disclosure protection wouldn't have to be limited to relating to pregnancy or relating to gender. It protects everybody regardless of their background.
Correct.
That particular piece, is that right?
Correct. Okay. Same with pregnancy and parenting leave.
Oh, sure.
A male, yeah. The non-birthing parent will also have ability to take 12 weeks of unpaid leave.
Okay. Yeah. So really this is helpful to folks from a variety of backgrounds. Thank you. Anything else from any members? Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just more of a curiosity. Are you finding that complaints come from any particular industry repeatedly, or if there's like a pattern where the violations kind of keep coming out of the same place?
Mr. Ali.
Yeah, I would say daycares and assisted living facilities are where we see the primary source of complaints, and that is because daycares face certain DHS requirements, child to teacher ratios that they have to abide by. So it creates challenges for them to be able to give pregnant workers the relief they need in terms of breaks, as well as the ability to take breaks to express, because obviously there need to be a certain number of teachers in each classroom. So they have to find relief. So that creates challenges for them. As far as living assisted facilities, healthcare in general, the limits on lifting 20 pounds creates challenges because they have fall risk patients and so forth. So I would say those are the two, then followed will be transportation.
Representative Berg?
Thank you.
Okay, and that's prompted a question from Representative Wayne Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. That question brought up something I was thinking about is, so I think you said one of the complaints is like in daycares, childcare, and stuff like that is the ratio teachers to students. Be curious to see what next year's report does, just because I was had a meeting with the Community Action Washington County and Ramsey, Washington Ramsey County Community Action, and they're really struggling with the paid family medical leave, and that the amount of teachers that are taking off. So it'd be interesting to see how those complaints rise, if they rise next year, from people saying they're put in that situation because they're like, what do we do? We don't have teachers showing up, and we still have kids that we have to take care of for parents that are trying to go to work. So that was just my thing. It'd be interesting to see what next year does. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Ali, are you able to, I guess I am curious about that, about how your enforcement of 181-941, the pregnancy and parenting leave, kind of interacts with paid leave. Is it in fact the case that you're the ones in charge of enforcement, or how does that work?
Yeah, so 181-941 is specific to unpaid leave.
Ah, okay.
Whereas the paid leave is for, you would have sure, to, there's
that program.
There's a 90-day gap period that the employee has to have worked for the employer before the protections sort of kick in.
Okay. Helpful.
And there's a few different are the differences between the two.
Okay, good.
But this is outside of that.
Okay, anything else from any members? Not seeing anything. Mr. Ali, thank you so much for your presentation and for your work into the department for making sure people's rights are protected in all these areas. Members, we will turn to, one second here, going to turn to Chair Baker in a moment. Mr. Chair, preview for tomorrow.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, tomorrow we're going to be looking into sort of the Promise Act grants that were done and have been done in the last couple of years. Round one has finished up in many communities. Round two is actually active, open in a lot of communities, and some are closing up too. What I wanted to do is just see what do we have left in the fund? How is it going? How could we do it better? There's more money there than actually is going out. I just want to take a little deeper dive about the Promise Act and the impacts of those for small businesses and just kind of where everything's at with that. So we'll have some testifiers from around the state who have been helping with that. So looking forward to a good day tomorrow. Thank you.
Looking forward to that, Mr. Chair. Members, thanks for the discussion today. With that, the meeting is adjourned.